anyway. Alright, so as for you, there's something there which I want you to pick up. If you haven't picked it up yet, you can pick it up on your way out. It's a long message from an email list I was on by somebody defending the traditional view of Islamic law against the people like Shaks. And I figured you ought to read that side of it. It's a reasonably articulate, sophisticated defense, and therefore I gave it to you. I should have given it to you a week ago, but it didn't occur to me then, so I came across it now. All right, so before I go on to talk about embedded legal systems or polylegal systems, let me, as usual, start by asking what things occurred to you reading the chapter and thinking about the issues with regard to embedded and polylegal. Anybody? Nobody? Well, if you think about an embedded system, the first obvious problem it faces is how to enforce its rules. All right, because an embedded system like the Amish or the Jewish during diaspora or various other ones is not the sovereign. There's somebody there who's got much more ability to compel obedience than they do, and yet somehow if they're going to have a legal system, they've got to have a way of punishing people who break the rules and enforcing the verdicts and so forth. And the simplest and least interesting solution, I think, is a solution that was typical in the diaspora in a number of other cases, which is you get the sovereign to delegate you authority, that they subcontract the job. And that describes the Jewish diaspora situation. It describes what I understand to be the Ottoman system, which we aren't discussing in this course, but somebody might end up doing something on it or read about it, where you had the Milots, which were a whole bunch of different ethnic groups, each self-ruling, each one with its head being subsidized by the Sultan, and presumably making sure its people didn't make any trouble for the empire and, you know, cooperated and so forth. But if you think about it, there's a sense in which we observe that system all the time. In fact, we are sitting in it at this very instant. That is Santa Clara University, I presume. I haven't been a student here, but I assume it's got rules. And that some of the rules, I suppose, if you're an undergraduate in the dorms, there are probably rules of behavior. And I presume that if you violate those rules in the last analysis, Santa Clara can call the cops and have you expelled from the dorm or something. I don't know the details of how they would do it. But if you think about it, there's a certain sense in which a whole lot of private institutions in our society, clubs, universities, corporations, have their own little mini legal system and use it to enforce the rules that they want to enforce and do it with some mixture of the different means we've discussed. That is simplest thing Santa Clara could do, which doesn't require any cooperation from the state, is to say, all right, you're expelled. We aren't going to stop you from coming to class, you know, but you're not going to get a degree. All right, that's, in a sense, like things like, that's something for reading, not for the moment, but something that's interesting. That's sort of like excommunication or like shunning kind of thing, in that they're taking an action they're entitled to do. And similarly, a firm can fire you and just stop paying you your salary. And you might have some legal recourse depending on the circumstances, but basically that's within their normal range of things. So if you think about it, what we're discussing really in these sort of exotic context, as it were, in a certain sense, is a feature of the system around us. Yeah.
One characteristic of cities, famous city, the cities of the Levant, which the Crusaders ran into, was the idea of quarters of the city being delegated or designated to particular religious groups. So there was, in fact, the Jewish quarter of Jerusalem, and there were other similar sorts of Christian quarter of Jerusalem, I believe, when the Crusaders showed up.
But of course, this is also true in European countries because that's what a ghetto was, right? The Venetian ghetto was the specific section of Venice where Jews were allowed to live, and I don't think they were allowed to live outside there.
And so that would allow you more easily to manage the legal disputes. So as
sure.
long as the people of a particular legal tradition are in one cohesive geographic area, then the conflicts
yep.
that exist there are all going to take place within there, and they can be
adjudicated yep.
by those courts. And if we prohibit or limit the ability of people to move in and out of that, you limit
yes.
the legal issues of conflict of laws.
Yep.
As well.
So that, in a sense, is less an issue of the embedded, though it comes in that, but more of the polylegal. That a way of that since the problem for the polylegal system, to which it's not clear there is a really good solution, though obviously societies find some solution, is the cross case. And if you have effective segregation by your same groups that have the different legal systems, that greatly reduces the number of cross cases. The neighbor you sue is also going to be a Jew like you or a Christian like you or whatever.
Yep. Walls between various areas, yep. Isn't it?
No, it's an interesting point, and a question I don't know is if that's the reason. That presumably, if you knew enough about these such cities, you could say, are the ethnic groups that define quarters identical to the ethnic groups that define legal rules? Or if not, then maybe there's something else going on. Maybe there's maybe the worry is that people of certain ethnic groups will fight each other, that you know there's hostility among groups, and therefore you want to separate them. If you think about what happened, say, when Yugoslavia, when the central Yugoslav government collapsed, you then got a lot of violence that had been being repressed up to that. Yeah.
Chinese did the exact same thing with the Manchu. When they occupied the cities of China, they established Manchu quarters of the major Chinese cities, which is where their garrisons live, have families, and I'm betting that they were subject to special law.
Yes. Yes, it's not that they weren't subject to Chinese law. It's that Chinese law treated certain categories differently. We'll get to that, actually, when we get to Chinese law. But yes, because I should say for those, I assume that not everybody is an expert in Chinese history, but the Manchu are the last dynasty before modern times, and so they're the dynasty which, when we're looking at Chinese law, we've got a book with a whole bunch of cases, and those are all from the Manchu dynasty. They're basically mostly 19th century, some of them ending 18th century cases. So that's certainly one approach which makes sense. Both if you have an embedded system with delegated authority, it makes it easier, but also if you have a polylegal system, is that you geographically segregate people. And of course, you'll observe that's happening here as well, that the undergraduates in Santa Clara are mostly in dorms, and those dorms are particular places, and so the neighbor who's playing the music too loud is not a Stanford student, but a Santa Clara student. Be interesting to know whether you get noticeable differences in the pattern in places like community colleges where most people don't live on site and therefore you have less inter-student It's interesting. I'm thinking if you have, that presumably some colleges do have rules about how students have to behave to each other, that there's been controversy over speech codes and such. And I wonder if you end up having much less of that if you don't have a geographically distinct community, which, I mean, be interesting even to compare, in a way, if you start thinking of it as a research project, to compare the kind of college which is sort of isolated out in the countryside with the kind that's in the middle of a big city, and therefore where the interactions are much more broadly with the wider group. People, all of that might be sort of fun. Okay. But in any case, so one solution to the problem of an embedded legal system is to have the government give you the right to enforce it. And, yep?
I was actually wondering about that, because there was talk last time, but about the how gain enforcement of legal systems. Now, I'm looking into like a separatist revolutionary enforcement legal system, and those seem to be sort of like an embedded system, except that its existence is strictly criminal under the system.
So that's an embedded system, but it doesn't have the option of having the state do its enforcing for it.
Right. So that it almost seems more like a polylegal system in that sense, where it exists almost entirely separate because it doesn't have to worry about
it. Well, but it does have to worry. The distinction I'm trying to make, and I agree it's not a really sharp distinction, is between the case where the different legal systems are seen as more or less peers and the case where one legal system claims and to some extent can enforce authority over everybody else. So if you think about the Gypsy case, say, it has a limited ability to enforce it. That is, the Gypsies are pretty... If you think about the whole question of why we care about privacy, which I've written various things about in other contexts, and one argument is that privacy is our only defense against the state. That is, that in dealing with other human beings, you know, I can also refuse to buy your product or sell to you. I can fight you off if you attack me. The state has an overwhelming superiority of force, So if I want to protect myself from the state, the tool to do that is to have them not know the things they would need to know in order to know them the guy they want to get, if you think about that. So that's one argument for why privacy might be a good thing. Another argument. But the thing with privacy, when you think about it, is that it's not an unambiguously good thing. Because even if I'm in favor of having my privacy, I'm also in favor of your not having your privacy. Because, you know, if I'm selling to you, I'd like to know if you went bankrupt in the past. If I'm, you know, considering marrying you, I want to know what your past love life and marital history and so forth were. So in a sense, that privacy looks like something which everybody wants for himself and wants to not have for other people, and yet there's a strong perception in our society that on net it's a good thing. And that's the puzzle which I try to wrestle with in one or two of my articles. And says that one possible answer is that it's important for protecting against the state or anybody else with overwhelming force, but the state is the obvious example that gives you a defense. So if you think about the gypsies, on the one hand, clearly the governments where they are claim the right to impose their rules on them. And there's sort of a fuzzy area between claiming a right and actually having it. If, in fact, you don't know somebody's name, because he used a different name when he did things, and if you go to his house and ask what his name is, they'll lie to you because they're all on his side, not your side, and all the people who do know are in the same situation. If you think about that, one of the, then in a sense, I'm going to argue that there are really three categories of ways that embedded societies enforce their rules.
That's actually, the way I saw it is you had two distinctions and I saw the potential.
What I was saying is that one method is delegated authority. One method is by doing legal things. And the other is by doing illegal things and getting away with it.
Right.
And that's the third. And they're related in the sense that the legal things bite, in a sense, depends to a good deal on the degree to which it's sort of a closed society, to which everybody in it wants to stay in it kind of thing, because it doesn't do any good to shun people if they can just go off and associate with non-Amish perfectly happily. And similarly, the ability to get away with doing illegal things largely depends on the fact that everybody who knows about it won't tell. And my guess, now it may not always be the case. If there's a chapter we didn't read in the Gypsy book, which is just discussing the early history in Europe, and it sounds as though there were points at which some Gypsies were feuding with other Gypsies and were trying to get the legal authorities to side with them. But even then, the legal authorities probably didn't know enough to know which side they should be on, because all they have is what somebody tells them. So in any case, so the delegated has the one disadvantage that you're constrained by the desires of the over society. So if you imagine, for example, if we take the case, let us say, of the mafia or some other group like that, there's a real problem saying, well, we'll punish people for not committing the... We'll punish the hitman who took our money and then didn't kill someone. We'll turn him over to the cops to punish him. The cops may not cooperate with that. So you have cases both where you're enforcing rules that they won't want you to enforce, or where enforcing your rules requires information you don't want them to have. And that's why I'm sort of puzzled. I mentioned earlier this whole question of to what degree the Gentile authorities are willing to punish people for... informing on fellow Jews. And I still don't know what the answer is. I know what Ilan says, and I know what Maimonides says, but I don't know clearly enough what we really
want.
It's
just illogical for them to do so.
You think? Except that I've got...
This guy, he talks to you guys and reports on bad things that the Jews do. It's like, why would you punish him?
Except that I've got the Chinese example. That one of the, I don't remember if I mentioned it because we haven't gotten to China yet, but one of the striking things about Chinese law is that for somebody to accuse his parent of a crime the parent is guilty of is a criminal offense by the accuser. So that's really the same case. That's the case where they are saying, if you help us enforce our law, we'll punish you if you're doing it. Is it for me? It's the same offense. All right.
It's a famous case from the Tang Dynasty in which a person makes the argument that they had to kill person X because person X killed their father. Filial piety demanded blood revenge in this situation. And the state, ultimately, the Tang Dynasty said, no, that doesn't fly. Our rules are superior to the rules of filial piety. We're either going to punish or not punish, but you don't get to take the law into your own hands. So the state was superior.
But I wonder if the state's position wasn't, yes, you're right, you should have killed him, and we should execute you for doing it. Because one of the other puzzling things that you get if you look at the cases is the situation where somebody is given orders by a senior relative. And there are pretty clearly cases where the court takes it for granted that he was supposed to do what he was told, but he's still criminally liable for doing it because it was something illegal, like killing somebody. And we'll get to those, some of those. So it does seem to me that the Chinese case seems pretty unambiguous, and that the way you interpret is you say, well, yes, they would like to be able to enforce their law, but it isn't infinitely valuable. They've got other ways of enforcing the law, and they also want to support this other authority structure because it's doing work they can't easily do. So that there's a certain sense in which, although I don't think it's discussed in the chapter, you would think of the Chinese extended family as an embedded legal system. I don't know how it worked internally. Presumably sort of a hierarchical system with basically senior relatives bossing junior relatives around. But you can say, well, look, it was the equivalent of the Jewish diaspora communities that I don't think it was criminal to not obey a senior relative. But I'm pretty sure that if the senior relative beat you for doing it, there would be no legal recourse against it, is my impression. So in that sense, it's at least accepting it. And the Chinese law has rules which reinforce that, which basically say that if a senior relative commits a crime against a junior relative, it's still a crime, but it gets a lesser punishment. Whereas if a junior relative commits a crime against a senior relative, it's the other way, it gets a higher punishment. And if I remember correctly, the usual rule in these things is that you'll go down by big steps and up by small steps, which is sort of interesting, that you've got like some category with three subcategories, and if you're gonna lower it merciful because of the empire is a merciful state from its standpoint, they lower it by all three, and if they're gonna raise it, they raise it. What if there's any other reason for that, I don't know, but I think that's one of the doctrines. So in any case, it seems to me that you've got that in a certain way, part of the fun of this is seeing the way some of the things we're looking at get reflected in what we're used to, but it's not used to thinking about that way. We'll come to more of that in a little bit. So that's the embedded one. And as I say, it's obvious constraint, really two obvious constraints. One of them is that there may be rules you want to enforce they don't want you to enforce. And another is that the process of enforcing the rules may require information you don't want them to have. Now, you can say, well, that's all right. We'll have our own court system. They'll just believe our verdicts. And that presumably is what's happening with the diaspora Jewish communities. And second mechanism is legal punishment. The second mechanism is things like shunning or excommunication. Things that anybody can do to anybody here. It's not like I'm obliged to talk to you. Sort of funny that nobody at all will talk to you. Well, not nobody at all, just no fellow Gypsy or no fellow Cheyenne or no fellow... No, those systems aren't identical, but you can think of it as a general category. So that's a method. And then the problem that raises is how do we enforce it? That is, we are the embedded legal system. And we have just decided that the punishment for him is ostracism. In whatever form our society, our rules permit. But let's take the extreme case, nobody can talk to him. None of us can talk to him. Why should the rest of you go along? Why don't you, each of you, say, well, look, none of them are talking to him. Boy, is he going to be grateful when I talk to him. He'll probably do me favors. If I want to buy his services, he'll work real cheap because no one else will hire him. If I want to sell him stuff, he'll give me a really good price because no one else will sell it to him. How do you, if you think of it from an economist standpoint, it's like maintaining a cartel. All right. The problem with a cartel is that it's always better to be out than in. All right. Suppose we've got five firms producing something, and four of them get together and say, "Look, we'll cut down our output in order to jack up the price." The fifth says, "Isn't that a great idea? You do that, and we will produce all we can and sell it at your high price." So that's my explanation of why the Saudis are always the good guys in OPEC. The Saudis want a lower price for oil than the small producers, because in order to push the price up, the Saudis and the UAE have to reduce their output because Venezuela and Mexico and Norway aren't going to reduce their output. That's my guess of what's going on in the politics of OPEC. So similarly here, you can think of the shunning as sort of a cartel agreement. All of us agree we're all, just as all the members of the cartel are better off if all of them reduce output and push up prices, all of us gypsies or Amish driver are better off, except maybe for him, if all of us enforce our rule, but each of us wants not to. And what are the solutions to that? Because there are at least two different solutions that we observe to that system. One of them is essentially religious. One of them is contagious pollution. And it turns out that that shows up again and again. That if you look at Cheyenne Law, which we're not covering this year, but have covered in past years, and I don't remember if I have a chapter. I think I may have a chapter on the Cheyenne in the book, even though you're not being assigned it. That in the Cheyenne Law, if you kill another Cheyenne, you smell of death. And it'll spread. If other people associate with you, they'll smell of death too, and that's bad luck. Things are not going to go well if the people smell of death. Therefore, you're automatically exiled from the tribe. Whether or not you've got a good excuse for killing somebody, whether or not it was self-defense, at least if you believe our sources on this, eventually it sort of somewhat wears off. And 5 years later or 10 years later, you could come back to the tribe and petition to be let in. And if the relatives of the guy you killed don't object, and if you brought a good bribe, a couple of horses loaded with tobacco or something, then they, and they liked you, and maybe if they thought your killing was sort of justified, at that point they let you back in. But for the rest of your life, nobody else will share your pipe or eat from your bowl. Because you still have a bit of the contagion. You get the same thing in Athenian law. I don't know if I mentioned to you, but I came across this wonderful bit. One of our sources for Athenian, one of our main sources for Athenian law are the speeches that orators wrote for plaintiff and defendant to use in the case. That basically, you couldn't, they didn't have lawyers in our sense. You had to plead your own case. There was a little bit of an exception for a friend speaking for you. But basically, you had to plead your own case, but you could hire an orator to write you an oration that you would then memorize. Some of those orations survive as literature, and so they give us information on the Athenian legal system, but it's sort of odd information because you normally have only one side of the case. You don't know whether the guy won, whether the jury was convicted, whether it was convinced. You don't know if the other side had crushing counterarguments. You only know what one side said. But we've got a bunch of those. And there's one really neat one where a man is basically, two men go off on what I guess is a trading voyage. And at one point, one of them disappears. And it's not clear what happens to him. They're in port at that point. He doesn't come back to the ship. And gets back to Athens, and various people accuse the other one of having murdered him. And they present what they claim is evidence that he did it, and the other person counter evidence. But my favorite bit of it is that part of the defense argument is to say, look, we know that murderers will have bad luck. We know that committing murder is pollution, just like the Cheyenne. Consequently, if I had killed him, look, this was only partway through the trading voyage. I went on. I went here and here and here and here. Was there a storm that sunk my ship? No. Did somebody attack? Did pirates attack me? No. Well, obviously, if I was guilty, something like that wouldn't happen. So this is evidence that I'm innocent. I thought it was just sort of great argument. And it also supports the idea that something like the Cheyenne view is at work. And
they've done immediate karmic retribution.
Well, maybe not that immediate, but you know, he doesn't know exactly which thing would have happened. Similarly with Marame among the gypsies, it's pretty clear that if you're polluted, bad things will happen to you. You'll probably get sick or something. So that's one solution, as long as people believe in it. And of course, the problem is that maybe there's an advantage to not believing in it if it's not true, but on the other hand, it's not like you have a good source of data, and doubtless parents will teach their children that it's true, and so forth and so on. So that's one fairly common solution that you observe. Then there's an alternative solution. The alternative is what I think of as the bootstrap solution, lifting yourself by your bootstraps. And that is, why won't you talk to him? Because if you do, we won't talk to you. All right? So that you have the self-consistent system, which is there are certain offenses which are grounds for your being shunned, and not shunning somebody who has officially been shunned is one of them. And as far as I can tell, that's literally the case for the Amish. That for the Amish, now you can talk to them, that one shouldn't exaggerate, but the minding, the shunning under the Amish system greatly restricts your interaction. And in particular, you're not supposed to eat at the same table. So that if an adult son of yours has been shunned, it is legal to let him keep living in your house. Though I think it may be that if he's living in your house, you can't go to the services or can't take communion or something. But I think it's not punishable, even though it may restrict things. I'm not sure. But he eats at a different table, or you have a separate tablecloth to symbolically mark off a different table. So there are restrictions of that sort. And if you don't maintain those restrictions, husband and wife don't have to separate, but they can't sleep together if one of them has been shunned. If you don't do things, that's itself grounds for shunning. And you can see that in a variety of other contexts. I would argue this is in fact the way we do it too. That I've just been in a very extended online argument with somebody on the question of whether there are substantial innate differences in behavioral and intellectual characteristics between males and females. And my argument is you would expect there to be, because evolution has designed us for reproductive success, and the central male-female difference is their role in reproduction. So the same patterns of behavior that are optimal for a male are not optimal for a female. Sure, the obvious thing is that seduce and abandon doesn't really work for females. Right? But if a male can get away with it, it gives him reproductive success. You know, the kid won't do as well as if he supported it, but better than nothing, it costs him nothing in effect. So anyway. But one of the things that's striking, the person I'm arguing with is trying to argue, well, it's not that I actually have good reason to believe your thesis is wrong, but we shouldn't believe it unless we're absolutely certain it's right. And that partly reflects the way in which certain beliefs are enforced in our society. That if, I don't know how many of you followed the flap when the president of Harvard, Larry Summers, in some public statement suggested that perhaps one of the reasons, I think that was maybe the second or third most important reason, that in certain academic fields there were very few women, might be a real difference in the distribution of abilities between men and women. And he got enormous criticism for it. And it seems to me that one way of looking at that is that you're not supposed to believe this. And if other people believe this, you're supposed to attack. And I think there are a set of views, some of which may be true, some of them false. That doesn't really matter from this point. But we have a society where, legally speaking, we have pretty strong rules on freedom of speech. So that there is nothing illegal about saying that the Holocaust didn't happen. In the U.S., there is, in, I think, Germany at this point, maybe some other European countries. There's nothing illegal about saying that blacks are inferior or you know, that Orientals are all in an evil conspiracy to rule the world or any of the sort of very unpopular beliefs which somebody at some point or other has held. Nothing illegal about being a Nazi or a communist for that matter. But some of these things will have very bad consequences for you. And that if you were applying for an academic position in a field that had nothing to do with it, and it turned out that you had been publicly arguing in favor of South African apartheid, the odds of you getting that position would drop a whole lot. That's my opinion, having been in academia most of my life. And you can think of a bunch of other things where there is an implicit rule of this sort, and part of what's enforcing it is the bootstrap system. Part of what's enforcing it is that you show that you're a good, you know, respectable member of the community by saying, I don't like him either because he held this unpopular view. And as I think can be used to suppress both truant and false views. An interesting case which I haven't looked into is the whole issue of diets. That my elder son is currently a fan of one of the odd diets, one which is referred to as Paleo 2, because it's the descendant, at least, of the idea of figuring out what our ancestors before the agricultural revolution ate, saying we're probably well adapted to those foods. Now, Paleo 2 is more complicated than that, and the argument is more nearly the things that were added to our diet after agriculture are suspect. And we have to look at evidence. Some of them are probably safe, some of them aren't. And the evidence is mostly looking at modern primitive peoples, where some of them are still eating their traditional diet, some of them are eating a modern diet, and the claim is that the ones who are eating a modern diet suffer from certain disease, certain problems such as diabetes, that the other ones don't. I haven't looked into it well enough to know if it's true or not. But what strikes me is that you've got an orthodoxy. The orthodoxy is saturated fats are bad. You ought to eat lots of vegetables and fruit. Sugar is bad, too. That overlaps with that particular diet. But the real point is that at any given time, I suspect, though I may be wrong, that it would be somewhat risky for at least people in some positions to adopt one of these things. Depends on your position. It's not that centralized a system, but that maybe if you worked for the Centers for Disease Control, you might find that if you also argued for one of the otter diets online, people would start looking at you askance because, look, if it's true that the orthodox view is right, you're promoting ill health by preaching this nonsense. So anyway, it seems to me if you think about how systems that depend on shunning are enforced, you really have milder versions of that in the world we ourselves live in. That we have no legal restrictions on freedom of speech, but some positions are very unlikely to get argued. The only person I can think of who has really given evidence against the claim that blacks do bad because of innate inferiority is Tom Sowell, who is somebody who is perfectly willing to say politically incorrect things, which is why he's willing to look at the question. And he's got a very interesting book called Ethnic America, which looks at the pattern of different ethnic groups coming in and what happened. And he argues that, in fact, the pattern with blacks coming up from the South looks very much like the pattern of Ashkenazi Jews coming in, you know, 50 years earlier from Eastern Europe, like the pattern of Irish coming in and so forth. And the interesting point he makes is that West Indian immigrants to the U.S. do just fine. If his data are right, in one generation, the average family income of West Indian immigrants is equal to the average family income of the U.S. West Indian immigrants are genetically blacker than American blacks. So if what's really going on is genetic inferiority, it should strike them even more strongly, and yet it doesn't. Now, he doesn't think it's discrimination either. He thinks it's cultural characteristics, that one result of Southern slavery was patterns of behavior that he thinks don't work very well. And he makes an argument on the difference between West Indian slavery and Southern slavery. I don't know if he's right or not about that. But it struck me that it was because Sowell is somebody who doesn't care if people call him names, so to speak. He's sort of a black, I guess, conservative libertarian, some mixture of that economist. That therefore, he actually thought about the question and provided some useful evidence, whereas for the most part, that's the kind of question that if you're sensible, you stay out of. And, you know, if you knew that your investigation would give the right answer, it's safe. But if you're afraid it might or might not give the answer, it's politically popular, you would be well advised to avoid the subject. So anyway, so all of that seems to me to strike, to fit into a good deal of this stuff, even in a different context. All right, so, you know.
Sorry, I have a question. So our legal system, the common law, if we go back far enough in time, you've run into the Norman conquest of England, which is imposing a new type of legal system, I believe, onto the population that's there, which is, I believe at that point, a Germanic legal system.
Yeah, but that's an overstatement. That's an overstatement. To begin with, of course, the Normans were also Germanic. They were Scandinavians, originally, who had conquered a chunk of France. And my impression is that although the Norman law did modify things, that there was continuity and that to some extent the Saxon law had been being modified by Saxons earlier. That it looks to me as though the pattern pre-Norman conquest is a gradual shift away from the sort of Icelandic pattern in which everything is thought of as a tort against the victim towards treating more and more things as also being offenses against the crown. And that one of the problems with that is that when you do that, it becomes less and less in the interest of the people immediately around the offense to do something about it because they're not the ones who are going to collect the damages anymore. And you then have to set up mechanisms to force people to give them a legal obligation to report crimes and such. But I'm certainly not an expert on that history, but I don't think it's a discontinuity, except that I think the Norman view of the feudal system is different. I think it is the case, I believe, that the Norman view has everybody holding from the king, but I don't think that was the French view. I think the Norman position was rather than saying that the lowest level feudal lord owns obligations only to his superior, who owes obligations to his superior, and so forth. I think the Norman position was that the lowest level still has obligations to the king. The question, in a sense, is, suppose there's a civil war. Is anybody below the top level doing something wrong? And I think that the standard feudal attitude would be no, that if the Duke of Normandy had rebelled against the King of France, the liegemen of the Duke of Normandy are supposed to follow them. That's who they've sworn to. And I think the Normans tried to impose the other rule, but I'm not an expert on history of feudal.
Well, I was trying to make the argument that the Norman movement in England was essentially would be an example of what a polylegal system. So we got the native population, which is the vast majority, following their own traditions, holding, you know, things to debate issues, and then you have the separate legal tradition, which is the Normans are coming in with, which are the more Roman influence of the course, and then we have these two things that gradually merge into each other. But I'm not sure if that's an accurate analysis.
I don't know enough about it. Yeah, I don't know enough about it. But in any case, so we've got so the legal things, versions of shunning, are one possibility, and then the other thing is versions of excommunication. And the excommunication has the virtue that you don't have to get everybody else to go along with it, because somebody at the center is controlling your religion. There is somebody, you know, some kind of religious hierarchy which can say, sorry, if you show up at Mass, we won't let you take the host, and so forth. So that's got some advantage in that it doesn't, everybody else can sort of be passive rather than everybody else having to help out with it. The one worry you might have about it, that's the one disadvantage that goes along with the advantage, is that it can be more easily abused by somebody at the center. So if you imagine that you're the Pope, and you say, well, why did I excommunicate him? Because the King of Spain is my ally, and the King of Spain is having trouble with the Kings of England, who, among other things, is just claim to no longer be married to the sister or daughter or something of the King of Spain, so I'm going to excommunicate the King of England for political reasons, and I don't have to have all the rest of the Catholics in the world agree with me, only the people in my hierarchy who have got some authority. I mean, you can think of, there have been other cases. I mean, I think John gets excommunicated much earlier for as a result of a different royal authority versus church authority quarrel. So, and if you think about for a moment the modern case of the FLDS, the Fundamentalist Mormons, one of the claims that's being used is that their prophet uses his power to pressure men to let their young, relatively young daughters marry him. I don't know if it's true or not. I mean, I'm suspicious of everything said about the FLDS, because some of the stuff being said pretty clearly wasn't true, and it's easy to say nasty things about people everybody hates. But it could certainly be true. And you could see how that's a potential disadvantage. Much harder if you said everybody will shun you if you don't do X, because other people may not agree with me about that. So that's another method. It's worth noting that all of this can be in degrees. That is, you think of excommunication or shunning as all or nothing thing. I had a paper some years ago on the LDS, the Mormon Church, the Church of Latter-day Saints is their official name, by a student who was in fact a member of the church and who interviewed her bishop to get information for the paper, which I thought was really neat. And a while ago I ran into somebody who I gather is not only a Mormon but at some point was part of their judicial system. And I hoped at some point to get him to read the paper and tell me what's wrong with it and see if I can improve it, maybe eventually do a chapter on that. But in the Mormon case, you've got, there are some similarities to the Amish, because the Mormons also have bishops who are amateurs, who are not trained and I think are not paid, and the bishop is a bishop over a relatively small, what's called a ward, I don't know how many families, but the impression you get is a similar size. But the difference is the bishop is not chosen by God except at third hand or so. The bishop is chosen by the president of the stake, which is the next unit up. So that in fact, looking at it, rereading the paper, it occurred to me that it looked a little bit like what the Amish might look like in 200 years if the potential centralizing tendencies work their way, so to speak. And as I discussed, in Lancaster County, you have this twice a year meeting of all the bishops, and I think there's also a meeting of the other clergy as well, and they discuss what everybody should do. And they can't compel them to do it, but they've got influence. Well, the LDS has a twice a year meeting of all of the LDS, and there are whatever, 16 million of them or 18 million of them, and the ones who don't make it to Salt Lake City can attend via satellite broadcasts. In the course of which the people at the top of it sort of explain what the situation is, and people can presumably raise issues and all the rest of it. So it looks a little bit the way, say, the Amish might if that kind of pattern gradually over time turned into an overgovernment. And you could imagine a situation where only one bishop is nominated in each congregation among the Amish, and he's the one who the senior bishop of the settlement says you ought to nominate. It's not what happens now, but anyway, that struck me really interesting in terms of comparing them. But in any case, in terms of the LDS has this elaborate set of stages in which you are baptized at 8. If you're a boy, you become a priest at 12. There's a different channel for women. And having become a priest, there are then further stages as you get sort of higher and higher up in the system, of which sort of the highest ones almost nobody does, but there's apparently a series which most people normally go through. And at some point in this process, you get what's called a bishop's recommend, which is a piece of paper saying this is a good law-abiding member of the church, therefore he can go into the temple. That, as I understand it, if you are a baptized 9-year-old, I think you're not allowed in the temple. And I think even if you're a 14-year-old in good standing, you're not. But at some point in this process, you get this recommend from your local bishop saying, yes, he can be admitted to the temple. This matters, because that's the only place you can get married. For a real marriage. A real marriage lasts forever. Not just till death do us part. The LDS regard that as a pretty women view. For eternity, a real marriage is supposed to last. But that only counts for a marriage to another believing Mormon, which has been celebrated in the chapel, in the temple, if I understand it correctly. And then in the Mormons, like the Amish, on the whole, believe in obedience to government. I think the Gypsies probably don't, although I'm not sure they actually come out and say so. But in fact, according to the paper, the Mormons are one of the few Christian groups that's permitted in Saudi Arabia. Because the Saudis trust the Mormons to keep to the rules that the Saudis have set for them. They cannot have any meeting of more than 20 people. They can't proselytize. They're restricted in various ways. But in any case, the LDS can do a sort of a lesser excommunication, which is saying, sorry, we won't let you in the temple. You can't do, and there are sort of, it looks as though there's a set of different things, different privileges of being a Mormon in good standing that can be lifted from you. And they have their own legal system, and it mostly doesn't interfere in quarrels between people, but it comes in accusations of sin, essentially. And the lesser accusations of sin, they basically tell you, go repent, but the more serious ones, they can have their own legal process, which is discussed in this. That divorce, for example, that your divorce isn't really binding from their standpoint until they've approved it, at which point you don't get to be married forever, I guess, in eternity after all, and that I think it's the case that if you get a secular divorce and have not had it approved by their authorities, I don't think you're allowed in the temple, if I remember the details correctly. And there are sort of various things of that sort, and they basically distinguish between two levels. Disfellowship means you've got all your privileges, but they're suspended. So you can't do X, Y, and Z, but once you satisfy them, once you have paid their penalty, as it were, now you have everything back. Excommunication, you are no longer a Mormon. You're back at ground zero. And if you satisfy them and you get readmitted, you're now a newly baptized 8-year-old, as it were. And there is some procedure by which you can get a fast track back to what you had, but it's not automatic. So that struck me as sort of interesting in terms of a sort of a modern embedded system with a fairly elaborate and sophisticated set of sanctions at different levels. But all of which, of course, still depend on you really wanting to be a Mormon. They still depend on either for social reasons or because you believe in the religion, on your being wanting to be a member, a continuing member of this. Of this group, so all of that struck me as sort of intriguing, as something that we hadn't covered but was relevant to what we're doing. So then finally we come to the illegal punishments, and if you looked at the discussion of the Roman child in the Gypsy book, when you cheated me, I threatened to use violence against you, and the particular guy in that particular incident, if I remember this discussion, was somebody who was currently had been charged with attempted murder in some other conflict. So you have to take pretty seriously when he threatens to use violence against you. And one assumes that once in a while the system breaks down. The system is supposed to be that either you back down or you leave town. But if you do neither of those, maybe I end up killing you, or maybe I end up beating you up or something. That's, all of that is illegal. So that sort of is the third option. And if you look at the description of the Kale, the Finnish gypsies, it's true they reduce the potential conflict with authority by the fact that their blood feuds are mostly done by avoidance rather than by violence. But nonetheless, violence is a legitimate part of it. Duels are, I'm sure, illegal under Finnish law. The Granfors, the guy who's the source for that information, comments, I think somewhere in the chapter, that he's very reluctant to testify in law cases in the Finnish courts involving the Kale, because if he testifies truly, he's going to have to say, yes, here are the things which under their rules they're entitled to do that happen to be against the law, like fighting duels with each other. And he doesn't want to do that for obvious reasons, because he wants to maintain a friendly relationship as an insider who's able to get information about the Kale. So you can see that sort of is the third approach, using illegal violence. That would obviously be the approach in criminal systems. But it's not clear how good criminal societies are about enforcing rules. There's one study I came across where there had been wiretapping of illegal bookmaking in New York quite extensively. And somehow some economists got a hold of the stuff. And I think it was economists, at least academics of some sort, and analyzed what you could learn about the bookmaking industry from the wiretaps. And that one conclusion was that you had a subcontracting system. If I'm a bookie, I don't mostly go to customers myself. I've got an agent, and I'm not sure if agents work for only one bookie or several, and he goes around taking bets and paying off on bets. And he has an account with me. So that basically, if he takes a lot of bets that win or lose, money will pass between the bookie and the agent. But if the agent ends up in a situation where he owes the bookie a good deal of money, he may just disappear. And it sounded from the wiretaps that the bookies really did not have a very good way of punishing agents who stiffed them, as it were. So that's the case. Now, there may be other ones where they have much better ways. I suspect that the mafia is a better organized illegal activity. We'll eventually probably have a paper on the mafia, maybe more than one. We'll see. And that we can see how they do it. But you can certainly see that there are, on the one hand, if you have a criminal enterprise, you want ways of enforcing the rules. My theory about organized crime in the U.S. is that it's not really General Motors. It's really a Better Business Bureau. That if you think about it, if you stiff me on a deal, you sell me what's supposed to be cocaine and it's really talcum powder, well, I hire a hitman and have you killed. But if that's all I do, people are going to be very reluctant to sell me anything, because how do they know whether it was talcum powder or not? So instead, I go to some local capo, so to speak, somebody with high status in the criminal underworld, and I say, look, here's the evidence that she stiffed me. And he asks you to come and give your side of the story. And if he says, yep, that's the bad actor, compensator else, now if I have you killed, nobody will mind. I'll just say, well, we better treat him honestly in the future, because it's sort of risky not to. So that's my, I'm not going to be able to prove this. This, it seems to me, is at least consistent with the data. That this actually goes back to a point that my uncle, who was one of the early law and econ people, made a long time ago. Which was, if you looked at court testimony about organized crime in the U.S., it neatly divides into two halves. One of them is the ceremonial stuff, where it looks as though there's sort of this large-scale organization, and you have blood oaths. The other is people describing how they do their business. And they aren't describing doing business as being employees of a large firm. They're describing it as essentially small-scale self-employed businessmen in various illegal activities. And that fits the idea that it's hard to run large firms in criminal enterprises, because large firms need information moving up and down the hierarchy, and that's information you don't want to get out, because it'll get you locked up or executed for your crimes. And that therefore, it's a relative, criminal firms tend to be fairly decentralized with interactions between them in the sense of a marketplace, but not very much hierarchy. Anyway, so that's a digression, but it's sort of interesting, because that's one of the places where we have legal systems that are interesting that we don't know very much about, because they're obvious. Yeah.
What about the more organized criminal systems, like in Japan, where they have
The Yakuza.
Yeah, like
yes.
Very organized.
Yes, well, I had a paper on that, and it seemed to think they did a pretty good job of enforcing things. I don't know if that's one of the web papers or not. If it is, you can look at it and see, because I thought that was interesting. Yeah, no, I'm sure this varies, but I think in the case of the Yakuza, you're not talking about a national organization. You're talking about a whole bunch of separate organizations which interact with each other. So again, it's still fairly small scale. And I think you're talking about, 10, 20 people, not 1,000 people.
Fighting between the Yakuza gangs accounts for probably more than 50% of all the murders that take place in Japan.
Huh, that's interesting.
It's ridiculous. They save society, and what little violence occurs is literally fights between gangs over territory.
Yeah. So, what?
One interesting side note of that is that a couple of years ago there was some study on great weapons originating from a substantial portion of the weapons used for crimes involved in coups in Japan came from the San Francisco Bay Area, particularly Daly City.
They
were purchased legally by Japanese Americans and then somehow found their way back to
Another funny thing is the Yakuza literally buys weapons so they can give them to police as a way to maintain good relations with local law enforcement agencies. They literally import illegal weapons into Japan so they can turn them over to the police and say, look, see, we're cooperating with you. You want your illegal weapons? See, here's 15 illegal guns. It's crazy. It's a literal importation of illegal guns just so you can curry favor with
the
buyer.
Yep.
They actually cooperate with the police where you can turn in their own people when there's too much... too much activity, they'll actually turn it over to some of their own people so that the police can say
no, that I don't know. But, I had one paper. I don't remember. I haven't reread it, so I can't give you the guts of it. But that was an interesting one to do. And I think in the case of the Vlachrom, I think there's some suggestion that maybe not currently, but sometimes they have sometimes done illegal things that you can have a Chris whose verdict is capital punishment, and then various of the people carry it out, and for that to work it basically depends on a society sufficiently sort of inward focused, as it were, so that it's going to be relevant. Or of course it could depend on the outside government not caring. You could certainly imagine a situation where the outside government says, we don't care what gypsies do to each other, why should we care, they're not really our people.
So I got another question. There is a society that we know very well, Canada, which has got to have different legal systems with the common law amongst the Canadian English and the civil law system under the French.
Yes.
I wonder how that operates.
I don't know. It's an interesting question. I hadn't thought of it. But of course, in a sense, we're polylegal too because we've got state law. It's just a more extreme. And for that matter, Louisiana is not a common law state. It's ultimately coming out of French law.
Every legal class will hear the disclaimer, this is true in all the states except for Louisiana.
Yeah, that's right.
Always the case.
So those are all cases like that. And I don't know how, if you think about places like Belgium where you've got the Flemings and the Walloons who speak different languages, are culturally different. I wouldn't be surprised if they have different legal rules, but I don't know. But all of these are cases where the groups are geographically segregated, and that's going to make it much easier. So all of these, in a sense, a common element to all of the ones at least we've been discussing, except maybe the delegated authority, is that you have to have some way of defining who's in the group and some mechanism that keeps group members in, as it were. Some reason why group members are loyal to the group, why they regard being expelled from the group as a really bad thing to happen, and so forth. And the first one of these that I looked at in the course and sort of was thinking about were the gypsies. And the gypsies are a pretty clear case. They do it multiple ways. They despise the rest of the world. The rest of the world despises them. And they have essentially religious beliefs which imply that it's really dangerous to have much association with the non-gypsies because they're all polluted. Who knows what you might catch from those people. So in that sense, you can do it. But one part of doing that, and one part which I think is getting harder and harder in the modern world, is controlling the acculturation of people, the process by which your children become you. And if you think about a not very mobile society, especially one which is facing prejudice from people around it, you can say, well, my kids are only going to play with other kids like them. They're not going to be taught by teachers who aren't from us. So they're going to talk. Everybody knows that X, Y, and Z is polluting, and that only those stinky foreigners, outsiders, or ignorant people, only they do things like that. And that's going to start to break down if you have the kind of situation where your kids are watching television programs from the other people, some of their friends are, they're going to school with other people, and so forth. So that's an issue which I think most of these things face. And one way of helping to solve the problem is language. Again, the French Canadians in Quebec speak a different language as their first language than the English Canadians, and that may make it easier to have a situation where it's natural for the French to mostly interact with the French and the English. It would be interesting. What's the intermarriage rate? Do anybody know?
I haven't seen the data, but I think it's pretty high.
Pretty high. So that would be one. That's one of the ways in which you mess up these things, because you now have families which are heavily interested in both ways.
The support for the Quebec liberation has declined over the last 50 years. The intermarriage rate might have actually essentially destroyed the desire for separatism.
That I don't know. It's interesting. But so languages, and again, the Gypsies have their own language. The Amish have their own language. They all speak English as a second language. But their native language, what they use in the family, what's most natural to them, is either some German dialect, which one, depending on which of the two major groups of Amish they are. So all of those are going to help maintain the us versus them kind of distinction, and that distinction is important to making the system work, I think. But then the other fight is over the schooling of the kids. And again, until recent times, this wasn't an issue because kids were basically educated by their parents. And, you know, maybe there was a schoolmaster in the village that you sent kids to learn how to learn things the parents couldn't teach them. But then you move to a modern society with mobility, with state-run schools, with compulsory schooling. You don't have a choice of not sending your kids to school. And now suddenly problems really arise for maintaining the separation. And if all of us live here and all of them live there, it's not such a problem. The less that's true, the Amish are not geographically segregated. There are a lot of Amish in Lancaster, but I assume they're probably a minority of the population, even in Lancaster County and most other places. They're smaller minorities. So if schools are small enough, you don't have to be very segregated, but as they get bigger, that becomes a problem. So that then becomes an issue for a whole bunch of them. And the Amish, you know,
They're U.S. citizens.
They pay taxes. I don't know if they have a Social Security number because they don't. Most of them don't pay Social Security taxes. The only ones who do, or at least did, I think still do, are Amish employees and non-Amish employers.
But the way that you would get it would be with birth, right? So Social Security numbers are handed out by the state of birth.
Yeah, it may well be that
they weren't born in a hospital.
But most of them are. Some of them are home births, of course, but I think they are mostly hospital births nowadays. And but in any case, they're for most purposes, they pay income tax, right? So probably so, but I don't actually know. Yeah. But as far as I don't know that they have any objection to Social Security numbers. I mean, in general, they believe in obedience to the state laws, except when they. If you know what matters for them, basically.
I guess I was thinking in terms of crimes that happen within sort of the Amish community, and if they're essentially sort of off the grid, if the United States doesn't know they exist.
Well, I think it knows they exist, all right. After all, they tried to make them put their kids in schools for a fair while. But I think the issue there is that it's hard to enforce the law if you don't have any local cooperation. You know, if you think about things like the problems in places like Vietnam, there's an interesting book by a environmentalist who doesn't much like other environmentalists, but he's critical of them, where he argues that the problem with preserving animals in Africa is that typically the locals don't want you to. That elephants are a goddamn nuisance if they're trampling your field and killing your kids once in a while. And his part of his complaint is that he thinks that Western environmentalists care too much about animals compared to people, the people being the local tribesmen. But his part of his argument is that if you want to preserve animals, what you have to do is to make it in the self-interest of the locals to preserve them. You've got to find some way so that the people who live there are getting a benefit and are therefore willing to put up with the costs. And he gives the analogy of things like Vietnam, where it's really hard to get rid of guerrillas if the locals are on the side of the guerrillas. They won't tell you when they come. So in any case, that's a kind of issue that's going to arise in cases like the Amish. Now, the Amish, as far as I know, they don't approve of doing anything at all illegal in enforcing their rules. At least I haven't seen any descriptions of their doing it. On the other hand, I think I mentioned the case of Shasta County, where you've got a set of norms of neighborly behavior that Robert Ellison, a Yale law professor, wrote a book about. And some of what they do to enforce their rules is mildly illegal. Namely, when your neighbor's cattle have trespassed on your field too many times and he hasn't apologized and hasn't tried to do anything about it, you drive his cattle out of your gate, start them away from his farm, and keep going as long as you're willing to, and then you let him go. Well, that's surely illegal. You're driving his cattle that don't belong to you, and yet it's permitted under the norms of that society. So that would be a U.S. case of the illegal method of enforcing your norm, which is sort of interesting. Going back to this question of controlling education, I've seen it argued that the U.S. public school system in part originated as a Protestant plot against Catholics. The argument is that it was founded by people who were worried about Catholic immigration, because there were a lot of Irish and Italian and very little Catholics, and who wanted to make sure that the kids of the immigrants got acculturated with good American Protestant values. And it, again, I don't know the evidence, but at least the claim is that if you look at the rhetoric at the time when the public school system was coming in, that was in fact one of the arguments. And of course, the Catholics to some extent responded the same way the Amish did by setting up their own school system in order to make sure that their kids got brought up learning things right, that's learning according to their beliefs instead of other people's beliefs. Now, it occurs to me there's one other element to how you enforce the system I haven't thought about before and don't discuss in the chapter, and that's bonding. And what I mean by that is, suppose we have a system, as I think the Amish probably do, where when you're a young adult, you are doing more than your share, and you then get a payback as an old adult. So that we say, when you're the grandfather, you're living in the grandfather house. You may be still doing some work on the farm, but you don't have to. But nonetheless, you're collecting enough of the revenue to live off of. And you think of any system where part of the norms is, in a sense, you could argue with the actual Social Security system, that Social Security system looks like a system for exploiting the young for the benefit of the old, and we pretend that it's an insurance system where you pay in money, but it's not your money you're getting back. Your money's been spent long ago. It's the money being put in when you're old by young people. So if you think about a system like that, you've got a real incentive not to step out, not to leave it once you get reasonably old, because then you'll never get back what you've put in. So that could be, I'm not sure if it's true of enough of these systems, it could be another mechanism for how you lock people into the system. And similarly, one argument made by the critics of the Amish, it's not the same one, but it's a different one, say, look, they bring up their kids in such a way the only thing they can do is be Amish, that they aren't trained to be lawyers and doctors and things. And I think that's an exaggeration, because they do seem to do pretty well starting businesses, and starting small businesses is one, you know, career option. But nonetheless, it's certainly a possibility that you get that part of the acculturation is the language you are fluent in and the language that only your people speak, the customs you're used to, you know, all the rest of it. And you can certainly see that if you dress as an Amish up to age 25, you're going to be not going to have a very good feel for how do people in the non-Amish world dress, what makes me look respectable, what looks silly, you know, how can I recognize which other people are of what status by their clothing, stuff like that. Hard to do in our society anyway, because they've got much less link between status and clothing than most societies have. But partly because clothing, cloth is very cheap by our standards compared to past societies. But anyway, those are all, it seems to me, sort of interesting points. It also occurs to me that in a way, there's something sort of like shunning that exists in non-embedded systems, and that's versions of outlawry. That one of the things we'll be seeing in Athenian law is that when you are accused of a capital crime in Athens, you have the option partway through the trial of saying, all right, I'm leaving. You're accepting exile in order not to risk execution. In Icelandic law, the enforcement mechanism, if you don't pay the damages that the court has adjudged, is you're declared outlaw. You have 2 weeks to leave Iceland. If you don't, you're fair game. The plaintiffs can kill you with no penalty, and it is tortious. They can sue somebody who rejects you. So, that's a system. Now, you might argue that that's just because you can't stop it. People can always, you know, you can run before the trial starts. But you can also argue that it's a way of getting rid of malcontents. So the one way of looking, I discussed it in the case of the Amish, is that the harder it is to leave, the more the danger of internal conflict, because now the more the people who are discontented stay and have to somehow make their terms with the system. So that's one possible element. All right, so far we've been talking only about embedded, and we're almost done, but let's talk a little bit about the polylegal and the four SUNY schools are sort of the example that more or less started me thinking about this issue. But I also heard a talk a long time ago in Chicago by a historian who was listing a number of other medieval cases that in Spain during the Reconquista, part of the terms on which Muslim territory would surrender would be that they be allowed to stay Muslim and to stay under Muslim law. And those always eventually got canceled, but that there was an extended period of time when you had areas under the rule of Christian kings that were Muslim areas. I wouldn't be surprised if it happened in other places. I know that the Norman conquerors of southern Italy had pretty friendly relationships with their Muslim subjects because there had been a good deal of them. Sicily was actually ruled by Muslims for a while, and there were substantial Muslim populations in Sicily and in southern Italy, southern and northern Italy, and there were, I think, Muslim troops that were part of the army of the Norman kings, as I recall.
They like to say that's where the origin of the mafia is.
Could be, yeah.
Code of Omerta comes from this.
Could be.
Muslim occupation is...
Yes, that I don't know, but it is the case. I mean, you can see sort of anecdotes in the medieval Islamic sources which sort of imply friendly relationships between those people. I know one pretty good one. But... Anyway, and I gather that on the part of Germany that's on the south coast of the Baltic, where you had Slavic populations with Germanic traders and such moving in and interacting, that the local Slavic princes would sometimes guarantee the Germans living in their territory that they could have their disputes settled under German law. So those are apparently a variety of examples. But then also, there's the society we live in, because after all, different states have different state laws, and even at the federal level, there is what's referred to as the law of the circuit, that in principle disputes among the circuits eventually get settled by the Supreme Court, but at any given time, you can say federal law is interpreted in this way in the Ninth Circuit and that way in the Seventh Circuit. Okay. So to that extent, you really have various elements of a polylegal system, even in modern U.S. And then it runs into the same problems, and the sort of two obvious problems for a polylegal system is, first, how do you define who is subject to which law? And second, how do you handle cross cases? And who is subject is really even more complicated. It is really not who is subject, but what controversies are subject. All right, you could have some controversies between a citizen of California and a citizen of Oregon in which it unambiguously was under California law, or unambiguously under Oregon. Probably some of you know more about this than I do, because I gather one of the things law students are supposed to learn is how conflict of law cases are settled. And so we have pretty unambiguous state citizenship, unambiguous geographic jurisdiction, but ambiguous non-geographic jurisdiction, because a real controversy can involve events happening in different states, among citizens of different states, and so forth. So that requires some elaborate set of rules. And sometimes the answer is it's not under any of them. It's a case which can't claim a state law, and then it can go to federal. It can go to a federal court citing under state law, but it then has to decide what state law is relevant and so forth. So all of that stuff really comes up in U.S. law as well. Going back to some of the older examples, presumably, in most traditional societies, you can't easily change your religion. that, not that there are no converts, but that mostly if you're a Christian in Cairo, your parents and grandparents are Christians, and your kids are going to be Christians. If you're a Muslim, ditto. And I guess if you're a Muslim who's an adherent of one of the schools, it's probably because you're from a Muslim community of people who moved there from North Africa 200 years ago or something, and they're all adherents. That's my guess. And my impression is that the schools tended to be somewhat geographical, although not perfectly geographical. A big city would have multiple schools, but the impression I get is that if you were in some area of North Africa, it was pretty sure you were Maliki, say, and somewhere else pretty sure you were Shafi'i. So you have a sort of a mix of geographic, ethnic, etc., defining membership. And as I think I made clear, I'm not really satisfied that I know how they handle the cross cases. And the obvious possibilities are one of the schools in a particular place gets to handle the cross cases because it's the ruler's school, or you could have some characteristic of the case. You could say that in a civil case there's a plaintiff and a defendant, so maybe it's the school of the defendant. That would have the virtue of slightly reducing the amount of litigation because it would be a disadvantage to plaintiffs, so you may have. I don't know if anybody did that rule. We need it if we found someone who did it that way. But in general, though, that's a set of issues which go across all these. Other comments, questions, discussions?
I made an attempt to find the answer to that question. I contacted Jeffrey Brands at the University of Montana. He did not know the answer.
All right. Yep. Well, that's so far what I've been getting as well. I've been trying to get answers to that. There is someone who's a scholar of that who had said he was going to get back to me because I'd asked him to ask my Islamic chapter, and he was busy with something else. But, well, something has to have happened. As historians, there have to be historians who know what actually happened, whether or not there's an official doctrine on it. If anybody can pick it up, this is an interesting defense of the traditional view of Islamic law by a modern Islamic person that I came across.